This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
From the ArmeniaProud.com studios,
Genatsit Hayed.
This is A Toast to Armenia with Jano Kabinjian. A comprehensive look at the Armenian culture, only on lineupmedia.fm.
Genatsit, Parlus, Inchpese. Chris, how are you?
I am fantastic as usual. How are you?
I'm doing great. Brian, how are you working the boards in our old studio? Yeah, he gives us a thumbs up.
The old thumbs up.
Thumbs up, meaning that's good. Anyway, well, you know what? That movie is right around the corner, The Promise. We are going to have the producer on, I think, April 17th of the movie The Producer. He wants to be on our show, and I think it's going to be great.
Wow, that's exciting.
My only thing that really now I'm starting to think about, Chris, is the whole crap that's happening right now with Syria.
In the world, yeah.
And I mean this in the sense that every time something like this happens in the United States, or not in the United States, but the world, we see who the American dependency is on.
Yep.
Turkey.
On Turkey, yeah.
So now it kind of devalues my movie, The Promise. Because now the Americans are saying, they will say, if we do need Turkey now, they will say, well, you know what? That's bad, but we really need Turkey right now. So it couldn't have come out in a bad timing like it is now, the movie. I mean, do you see that?
No,
now?
I do, yeah. And
I haven't thought about it.
Yeah, I haven't either. I have noticed. I mean, it's getting a lot of publicity and a lot of hype.
A lot of exposure.
I saw it on CNN the other night, on MSNBC. I mean, it really is all over. So,
right.
But the political climate.
Of us shooting off those damn tomahawks into Syria. I don't know why the hell we had to do it in the first place, but you know what? That's a whole new deal, and that's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
But in any case, now there's some tension there, and I know that America will grasp onto Turkey.
Lean onto Turkey, yeah.
It will grasp onto them and say, you know what, we need them. Yep. We need them. You don't offer me anything.
Yep, that's unfortunate, but I think you're right.
So anyway, that's the movie, The Promise. Hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully you're wrong. But you know what, that's the feeling that I'm getting.
No, I agree.
From all this. And it will dilute this great movie. And they're already comparing it to the movie. Did you ever see that one? I think it was late 80s or early 90s called Red. It was
I did see that.
Red.
A long time.
Me too. I saw it a long time ago. So they're saying it's something like that, and it's a well written story.
Yeah, and I mean everything looks like it was shot amazingly too. Like some of the overhead shots and stuff they showed in the ad I saw on CNN was really cool.
Yeah, and you know, the guy that put this money together, Krikorian, the guy died.
Yeah,
the guy died without ever seeing this movie. You know that he's in heaven right now with his popcorn, sitting by God and going, "Hey, you're gonna have to watch this one."
Yeah.
So it's going to be good that, it's still coming out and people are talking about it. We got some big time stars out there, American stars that are coming to its aid and saying, hey, you know what? You got to give it a shot. Don't believe all that.
Like every time I log into anything, any of my social media, I see somebody has shared it or someone has written an article about it, whether it be like, you know, the New York Times, LA Times, all over the place.
And that's a little bit of a thing that I wanted to say. God bless all of you out there that keep sharing this. Without you, there is no advertisement on this. They're not even putting it up. I don't see it every time as a preview or anything like that, as a trailer. Do you see it? Going to a movie theater?
I don't
see it like that. No. It's got to be you guys out there that keep this thread up, keep this sharing, and make it possible. And we're doing a good job. God bless. Well, I tell you what, let's move on here. And again, the promise, we're going to have the producer on April 17th, so please tune into that show as well. That's going to be a great one.
Absolutely.
So, Chris, that's that, and we just got to move on. And, hey, on the bright side, great stuff here. You know Michael Passion.
Yeah,
those YouTube videos. Jesus Christ, is that shit funny? I can't ever stop laughing. Whenever I see Michael Passion's work, I stop everything. I take my laptop. I go somewhere just laugh.
You better go somewhere private.
Well, folks, we've had Michael Passion on the show before. He's got some new stuff on the way, and I said, hey, Michael, you got to be back on the show. Michael, how are you?
Fantastic, guys. Thanks for having me on, man. It's a blessing. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, buddy. Wonderful. Anytime. Where do we start, man? Your stuff's funny. Your stuff's outrageous. How did you come up with this last one, man? This last one with the Japanese chef. That's creativity.
Thank you, brother. Yeah, so it's basically, I don't know if people saw, but it's a Benihana parody. And I don't know if some people have ever gone to Benihana, but basically it's a Japanese restaurant where they cook in front of you. And I don't go there a lot, but the last time I went there with my wife and some friends, I just couldn't stop laughing. And my wife was like, why are you laughing? What's so funny? And the entire time I was just thinking about basically writing the entire sketch out.
Oh, and, God.
To do a parody, and I was like, I gotta do like a first-time chef that basically destroys everything and gives everybody like their worst dinner experience ever. So when I came up with that, you're not really good.
You definitely do that with I don't want to give it away, but you guys got to watch it, and it's amazing. It's great stuff. And to me, Michael, I gotta say, man, it's your whole physical persona that just overtakes. I mean, I could say that bit that you're saying, and I don't think it would even be half funny as you doing it. I mean, you've got that Armenian touch in you that's you see in the Armenian theaters, the Armenian comedy. Yeah. You have that, and my God, you pull it off really well.
Yeah, I lived it. You know, obviously that's who I am, and I've taken that and basically put it into the modern world because I am Americanized. So I basically mixed the two together, and it becomes a really fun adventure. You know?
Yeah, for sure. Because it seems like when I see you doing this, and I know every Armenian out there has got a cousin or has a friend that is you doing that.
I agree. They have somebody that they can look back at.
Exactly.
They can relate to the character. Exactly. I had a fan who approached me. She's like, your characters remind me of my uncle.
And, I kid you not.
I was like, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I appreciate it.
No, it's a damn good thing, because everything that you say around the Odars too, it's probably the way we act, too, with, right there, you're going, sick to eat. It's just funny stuff. I mean, everyone, I know this show's a little conservative on the side. We have everyone that pops in. But I tell you what, this is stuff that you guys got to watch out there. And you've got something brewing right now with, you said, Netflix?
Yeah, actually, I got an offer to do stand-up comedy. They gave me 1 hour special, so I would probably be the first Armenian stand-up comic on Netflix.
Wow.
And that's a great blessing, too, so I'm very excited about that.
That's huge.
No, that would be excellent.
I mean, that's massive.
Yeah, yeah. When is this? Working it out right now, huh?
Yeah, I'm in talks with them. They're thinking of maybe airing it by end of this year. Possibly, so I'd have to shoot it first, do a live shoot, and then basically put it in the can and then turn it in. So I'm very excited for that.
You know what would be great? This is the first time I just thought of this. How great would it be for you and maybe a couple other comedians or whatever like that, if you could ever round up a group like that and just tour the United States. I mean, we are not. You guys are blessed in the LA area because you guys can do that stuff, Armenians can just get in their car, take a half hour trip, and sit down and watch this on a every week type of basis. But we don't have that luxury. How great would it be for you guys one of these days to go out there and tour and possibly even the Midwest? I mean, our area in St. Louis, I think that'd be great. We would definitely draw a lot of people for you, my friend.
Oh, we would love to come out. I got a lot of talented friends. We would love to do something like that and definitely hit your area. I think that would be wonderful. I think we're also going to concentrate on, you know, not only relaying the Armenian culture, but also just, you know, making it, you know, general so that everybody can enjoy the show, you know?
So
we're trying
of course.
To generalize the show at the same time, introduce the Armenian culture. I think that would be a fantastic move. We would love to.
Oh, please. My God. That would be excellent. And you know what? That enhances too. Yeah, folks out there, my Armenian friends, like in Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Miami, this really brings back some memories of when our parents used to go to like the nightclubs in our the Armenian comedians, the Armenian singers in Lebanon, in Armenia, in Syria, and all these places that they used to go to on a weekend type of basis. Now, I mean, if we plan something like this, if you guys hit the road, this would be an outstanding thing for us to see once a year or something like that. You make a tour in the United States.
Absolutely. I would love to nothing more to do that. Matter of fact, you guys could help us set something up. That'd be wonderful. It's definitely an adventure for us, and we love making people laugh, and we would love feedback from not just LA but throughout, you know, the country, like you said. So it would be fantastic.
Yeah. I think we should set something up like that. And folks, if you haven't seen Michael Passion's work, I tell you what, you're missing out, because like I said, we've all got a cousin, we've all got a friend that we can relate to like this, and Michael does a fantastic job, man. You're outstanding. God bless.
God bless you guys. You guys are awesome, and I really appreciate the support. And it feels tremendous to know that people actually appreciate the work. And I think that's basically my only reward that I would ask, is just people to go have fun, you know?
Yeah, and that's amazing that you say that, because I feel like that too. When I get a compliment, I get a private message on Facebook saying thank you so much. You guys are great, and I keep listening. And then I see where they're from, and it says something like Australia or something like that, and it really makes me feel good too. So you knowing that you've got even fans in the middle of the United States that tune into what you're saying, and that is rewarding for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, talking about that, I just wanted to piggyback on that. Somebody wrote on YouTube under one of my videos that they were from Iraq fighting, and it didn't specify who they were fighting or what they were fighting, but they were soldiers, and they were saying how during their break time they were watching my videos, and I was stunned. I didn't even know how to reply to that.
Yeah.
But I thought it was. Yeah.
Yeah. That is great. That is great. And you know what? Think of this, Michael. I've talked it over with Chris on this. How great is it if even our soldiers, our Armenian soldiers that are just relaxing and just seeing stuff on the computer, they could check out a podcast, they
Absolutely.
Could check out your videos and laugh, just laugh. That really cures a lot of stuff in you that's negative in this world, you
stress,
know?
Stress, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I agree 100%. And it's awesome that we can do that from the other side of the world.
Yeah.
You know, so it's pretty
For
cool.
Sure. For sure. Yeah. All right. Well, then definitely we'll set something up. I'll get back with you on that with maybe if you guys are going to be serious about taking this on the road. I will definitely look into it. And our folks, I got friends up in Chicago and all that. Let's set something up for these comedians make a stop in your city. That would be outstanding.
Yeah, we're ready for it. We are ready for it, man. Let's do this. We're in the works on a few projects, so 100%.
Excellent, excellent. And keep us in tune with that Netflix gig. I can't wait to see that. Yeah, we'll.
It's on air, you guys will know. I'm excited about it. It's going to be very nice. It's basically going to give me a chance to introduce Armenians and the culture and what we're about. And obviously not just the negatives, but also the positives. So I'm very excited for it.
Bravo, Yechpai. Bravo. Keep doing what you're doing, and we'll stay in touch, and I'll get back with you about possibly a summer tour.
Perfect, brother. Let's do this.
All
thank
right.
you guys so much. Okay, guys. Thank you.
Take care, Michael.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that was outstanding, Chris.
Yeah, really, really. He has some neat stuff going on.
Yeah.
But to be the first Armenian
on Netflix stand-up.
That's pretty cool,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, and you know what? He's friends with the show.
Nothing bigger than Netflix right now. I know.
He's friends with the show. Well, so we'll have a Michael Passion 3 coming up here.
I love it.
Hopefully soon, too. Hey, Chris, that was amazing.
That was really good.
I mean, Michael's covering, he's got YouTube channels that are funny as hell. And then
hilarious.
He's got this thing going out with Netflix, too.
Yeah, he's got some
outstanding.
Good stuff. Amazing stuff.
Well, it doesn't end there. You know that, because now we've got our wine segment with Anoush Garibian O'Connor. Anoush, how are you?
Hello. I'm doing great. How are you?
We are doing great here. We're actually in Studio B, where this all started.
Yeah, this is where the whole show began.
Yeah. 89 episodes ago, yeah, we were here.
We sat right in here with a laptop and a microphone.
Yeah, and now it's
definitely changed.
Now it's a studio, and we've got everything in front of us, but, we're ready to roll again. How are you?
I'm doing great. So 11 more shows, and it's going to be the 100th episode.
Exactly.
Are you planning something special, something fun?
You know what? I got to sit down with Chris, and we got to come up with something on that, and then we'll relay it with you guys and see what you think, and maybe all ideas, all hands on deck on that one. 100th episode would be big for us.
I was going to say, if we weren't before, we are now.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, today I wanted to dedicate this wine report on the state of Missouri.
Oh.
After we had the conversation about the Hillstone Winery and you sent me the wine, I wanted to do a little bit more research and talk about the state, because Missouri actually played an important role in the winemaking history.
I knew we were good for something, Chris.
Right. We had to be, right? There had to be at least one thing.
Yeah. All right, honest, fire away.
In the early mid-19th century, the German immigrants founded the wine industry in Missouri. And they called that little corridor Missouri Rhineland. And then later, the Italian immigrants also entered the wine production. And by the 1880s, more wine was produced by volume in Missouri than in any other state.
Wow.
So by volume, they were producing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was granted the first American viticultural area in 1980. So the designation came from there. Missouri wine country is now Hermann and Augusta, and the wines that you sent me were from Hermann. And then today's story is going to be on the winemaker from Augusta. But there is also other areas that the vines are planted and the wine is produced, but the main ones are those two.
Yeah.
So
I tell you what, in Hermann too, we've got an Armenian family that lives there. And my friend lives on a slope. His house is on the slope, like, and he is actually putting like levels of grapes. He's trying to hang, and it's
carrots?
Beautiful. What's that?
He's making carrots, like
exactly. And I said, Gamo, are you serious? Can you pull this off? He goes, watch. Next time you come here, see how far I've gotten into this. And so it's very interesting. The whole town, it just magnetizes around that wine. I mean, that's what the whole Hermann's all about.
Yeah, there was in 1980s, there was a big push by the government, like by the local government, to restart the wine industry. And a lot of people were encouraged, a lot of seminars, a lot of education. So if he's, you know, he can definitely get in touch with the chamber there. I mean, and then get some more information and help if he needs any. And even he can go talk to Mr. Kuyumjan, whom I was going to talk later on in the segment, but he owns two wineries, so he can definitely ask
for sure
advice and recommendation.
He'd love that too.
Yeah. So now there's. I wanted to give you a little bit of numbers so you can see how much it has grown. In 2000, Missouri had 31 vineyards. Hmm. By 2015, there were 128, and now currently it says 425 wine growers that produce 1.25 million gallons of wine.
Wow.
That is a lot. And the estimated economic impact is in dollars is $1.76 billion. So economic impact.
You're kidding. That much money comes out of wine from you know what?
Yeah, that's what I was able to find.
Yeah, it's amazing. I got to ask Chris this too. You would look at Missouri and the weather is not that friendly.
No.
I mean, when it gets winter,
it's cold.
It really hunkers down. So how does that become so moneymaker, you might say, Anush, with the climate not as good as Napa or Southern Italy or France or anything like that? How does that relate to making good wine in Missouri?
So there's two things. When Germans settled, it was very similar to their climate because it's colder and gets colder. And much of the in the Europe, in France and in Germany and Austria, it gets colder. So they plant particular grapes that will thrive in the climate. And here in Missouri, there have been developed certain varietals that they make wine from, or they use the native varietals. So for example, for the white, there's a varietal called Chardonnay, and that is a varietal that is a hybrid of Chardonnay. And then another French-American hybrid that was developed a while ago called Saval. So they don't plant, they don't grow any just older varietals, but the particular ones that work for the climate. And it is a very hard job to do to grow it there.
Right.
They say if you want to really. I remember somebody said it was, if you really want to learn how to make wine, you need to go somewhere like that to Missouri because it's so hard. The conditions are so harsh. And on the other hand, in California, it's so much easier.
Right.
It's just everything is so easy and the conditions and the climate.
For sure. So tell us about this Armenian in Missouri.
So the Armenian, Tony Kuyumjan, I talked to him on Monday. What a wonderful person. I asked him about his Armenian heritage. How did he end up in Missouri and in the wine industry? So his grandma comes from Harput, Western Armenia, and she came during the genocide. She lost all her family on the way. Went to Syria and through there, then came to Fresno where she joined her uncle and sisters, and they had vineyards. But the family never actually made wine. But Mr. Kuyumjan decided to go into aviation. He was not interested in growing the grapes, and the family wasn't making wine. So he went into the aviation and he was hired by Ozark Airlines in St. Louis, which then became Trans World Airlines and then American.
Right.
So he already decided to stay there. So he was traveling to Europe. He saw the vineyards, the vines, and his appreciation for that grew. And he decided to, that led him to become a winery owner. And he's also he's on the wine and grape board of the Wine and Grape Research Committee. That's why I was saying your friend, if he if he needs help or guidance, you know, because Mr. Kumjan is on the research board. He has done a lot, you know, help them with the development, with research and different studies. So he owns, back to him, he owns two wineries, Augusta and Montel.
Yeah.
And Augusta Winery is a historical, is the, in the historical town. They have little restaurants on the premise, so you can go have some nice wine, enjoy a nice picnic. His wines won several awards, best of show in California, best imported wine to Germany.
Wow.
Et cetera. He's a
big player.
Influential. Yes, he is in the Missouri wine industry. He definitely is. And besides that, a wonderful person.
Now,
he has five kids, ten grandchildren.
Wow. Now you said on that with this last part in the Missouri wine industry, do you keep him in a state like that, or is his name and his wine becoming more versatile throughout the region and possibly even the world?
There is so much wine produced in the United States. He is definitely a key influencer for the Missouri wine industry. He does import, I mean, you can buy his wine online, but you wouldn't be able to find it in the local grocery stores, let's say in California.
Mm.
But I'm sure you can find them in the, you know, in your state.
Right.
So.
And does that?
But.
Mm-hmm. I want to throw this at you too, Anusha. Do you normally? Are you looking? Is that the best thing if you're a wine company to just have it out everywhere, or do you want that 1-800 number, your own site and all that? Does that make your wine a little bit more on the upper side than just having it out everywhere? You know what I'm saying on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it all depends. If you have enough capacity and production to be able to be selling it statewide, because it is, the United States is huge, and people drink a lot of wine. So if you want to have your wine, let's say in California, you should be able to have enough to supply, because you need to constantly have it there. But also, you know, it's, of course it's easier to, you know, just go log in there on their website and buy it that way. But, it depends on how much they can produce,
right,
the capacity
right.
that they have.
So you're talking the volume is more important to them if they're going to get send it out everywhere. I thought maybe there might be a little prestige behind, you know what, we're not going to circulate it as much out there so we can so they can come to our site, they can order, and it's much more, I guess I'm looking for the word just prestige in that sense that people want to always buy the wine from that site.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I thought.
There's lots of things that go into the distribution, and it's not the distribution and the sales of wines is so complicated. There's like three tiers, two tiers, depending on different states. So, and like I said, the main thing is the volume. If you can, if you can produce enough. But for all the listeners, you know, who want to, they can definitely go on the website and they can definitely buy it. It was, I tried the wines that you sent, and this is the first time I was trying both of them, because one is a native grape, the Norton, and the same that the Mr. Kumjan's winery produced, and they were wonderful wines. First time ever tried them, but I was pleasantly, not surprised is not the right word, but I guess I can say I was surprised, because I've never had it. I didn't know what the varietal is. So definitely worth trying. perfect with food because the wine has like a good acidity, a good balance that goes with meat. I tried the Northern, the red, and then I tried the Chardonnay, the white. So both were excellent. But I wanted to say, I asked Tony, like, tell me something super exciting and about what's going on currently with you and the vineyard. And he said that he actually brought in some cuttings from Armenia of Areni vine. And
I was going to ask you that. I was going to ask you if he did that.
Yes, he did. And he's waiting for the vines to come out of the quarantine. And then he's going to plant them. And he's going to see how this varietal Areni is going to be doing in Missouri. I was so excited. I'm like, oh, can I say that? Can I talk about it? And he says, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're going to test it and we'll see how it goes, because he found a lot of similarities, like hot summers and cold winters, and the varietals also, together with Northern, they had similarities, like good acidity, good balance. So I was super excited about that.
I'm definitely thrilled about that too. Definitely, that'll be cool. Have an Armenian,
that would be great.
Yeah,
wine, Armenian vines in Missouri.
Well,
so
the
view, yeah, it's
the
super
views
exciting.
At those wineries specifically. I've been out there to out of Montel.
You've been to Augusta?
Yeah, I've been to Augusta and Montel, I believe. It's been years ago. I mean, they're smart the way on a whole side note. They're smart about how they advertise. Because they like they spend a lot, like, you know, in the like spring to fall, and they're all over the radio in St. Louis. I mean, they sponsor a ton of stuff, so they, like, especially in that range of the year, they have a high profile. I know. I mean, it's huge. Yeah.
Why don't they get on and sponsor us? That would be great. Well, that's
absolutely.
That is beautiful.
Go visit him. Yeah.
I have to
visit them. They're not too far, and you can make it a nice Saturday or Sunday. They have nice food there, a nice cafe that, you know, just hang out and, you know, have a good time, good conversation. Hopefully he will be there, or, you know, you can call and see if he's there. And
now, I know, Anush, I know that when I'm at Stone Hill, they have some German brats and stuff like that to where you can eat there as well, for at their restaurant there. Is there any Armenian influence to any of his restaurants that are next to the winery, or you didn't ask him that?
Well, from what I've seen on the website in Montel, it says they have a Klondike cafe that offers fresh, high quality cuisine to complement the wine, gourmet wraps, salad, sandwiches, pizzas. I am not sure if they have Armenian.
So there's
no
Urfa Kufta or anything like that, right?
No, but Helene said that she might come and open a winery. I mean, a restaurant over there.
Oh my God.
Did you say that last episode?
That would be great. That would be great. And she's the right person to do it too. She's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So, all right, then, is there any phone number you got from them that we could relay that out?
I will, yes, two websites for both wineries, and with all the information of the wines, you know, to purchase, very easy, you know, if you can't take the trip, you can log on, and the wines are very affordable. I mean, the prices are just amazing. Between 10, 11, 20, I think like the most expensive wine is 26. So it's like, can
How
buy
can
a variety, like a six pack. Yeah. And then, and beautiful wines. Yeah.
Good.
Very nice wines. So I will post, it's AugustaWinery.com. Very easy. And then the other one is, I think, MontelWinery.com. But I will post the links under the episode.
Perfect.
Yes.
Very good. And do you have any specific wines out there for us to try for this weekend?
I would say try the wineries, wines of Missouri. This is my week's suggestion.
Very
you
nice.
Either buy from the Hillstone or Augusta or Montel. Either one, try it because, like I said, I have tried for the first time. I absolutely loved it. I was very intrigued, interested, because it was something new, so much to think about, so much like to compare, to identify. It was a very exciting experience. So I don't know, sound too nerdy, but
no, that's
but
beautiful.
Just, you know, it was a very great experience to try a new wine. Especially with so much history behind it, with so much dedication, hard work for those people, you know, who try to make, who take pride in their work.
So. Right. And you know what, during, here's something to throw at Stonehill as well. When all that with World War One, World War Two, well, America was fighting Germany. And these people went through so much tribulation during that time, because you know, it was a German town, and these folks, they had to shut down their wines and everything. They went through a lot, and I'm sure any immigrant, even our Armenian people, I mean, we always have a, you know, tendency to be behind an eight ball, and we have to make our way out of it and to overcome. And that's what these towns are all about. They're from immigrants that worked hard, and that's definitely important to bring that up too. That whatever you were saying, I had to jump in and say, you know what, I see it every time I go there, how tight knit of a town it is.
It is hard, but it's so
rewarding.
So great to see how you're exactly rewarding to see. There was one more thing that I wanted to add, which also has a very big importance for the. So in 1800s, the France almost lost all its vines due to a bug, to a disease. And a scientist from Missouri, Charles Riley, he went there on an expedition, and he found out the problem, and he sent a bunch of cuttings from Missouri, and they grafted them, and then they saved the whole wine industry.
Wow. How about so that?
That's pretty incredible. That
yeah.
How
about that, Chris?
Got all the information.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yes.
It's all local, too.
So another thing to be, and another very important piece to the,
absolutely.
The whole history of the wine. So anyway,
well, that is great history right there.
It really is.
I mean,
I'm blown away.
And she picked all that up.
I know.
Just talking
this
to
was
you
a, yeah.
Bravo, Anish.
I need your brain.
Yeah. I could have used you in my history classes.
Yeah. Where were you?
Anyway, all right, Anish. Thank you so much. Great episode.
Really good.
I really did pick a lot more about Missouri wine.
I live here, and I know more than I've ever known from someone
exactly.
who's not from here.
Right. Exactly.
There we go.
And thank you so much, Anush. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch up with you next week.
You too. Talk to you next week.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was Anush, and that was amazing. The stuff that happened in Missouri and is happening now, and the guy goes all the way to Armenia to get vineyard from Armenia to plant here to get it going here, so we may be drinking Armenian wine.
So yeah, absolutely.
I'm really
That's
excited.
Cool.
Anush has got to be on top of that. It would keep us informed on that, and really excited about it.
Yeah.
Our next guest, not really a guest, our next segment, because he's part of the show now, Danny Bedrosian. How are you, my friend?
Dono, what's up, guys? Glad to be here again.
How are you, man?
It's outstanding here, Danny. I mean, we've had some great interviews, and we're going to wind it down with you. And I tell you what, I've been getting some great responses from people out there hearing a little bit about our history.
That's great. That's fantastic. I'm very glad to hear it.
Yeah, it is outstanding, because I even talked to Arderhyde, and he goes, that was a great show, Jono. And I was like, thank you. And, you know, I just knew that that history I never knew. And I know there's a lot of Armenians out there that aren't familiar with what you're saying too, Danny. So that, it's very appreciative. It's really keeping culture alive. And I can't tell you how much we can thank you on that one. That's beautiful stuff.
Well, it means the world to me. It's really my honor and my pleasure to be able to help further, you know, educate our people and both Armenian and Odar alike in this rich, valuable history that we can learn so much from.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And what do you have for us this week?
Well, I wanted to, you know, get into the importance of what April really is for Armenians. Of course, we know about the genocide, and of course, most of your viewers, I'm sure, know, if not all, about the importance of April 20th, you know, 24th, and the importance of recognizing that as the day when the, you know, the intelligentsia was rounded up at the very beginning of the eve of the Armenian genocide. But I don't think as many people know about the importance of April 1909, which is 6 years before the genocide, and it's known as the Cilician Massacres. And it was something I wanted to focus in on today because it basically takes place around this part of April, around between the beginning of April up until like the third week of April. And since L.A. County recently named April as Armenian History Month, I felt like this would be a valuable and important thing to talk about. It did happen in April 1909. And 25,000 Armenians were slaughtered in this extremely cruel massacre by the Turks. It was a very controversial massacre because it dealt with a lot of people were questioning whether it was Sultan Abdulhamid II who had done it, who was responsible for the Hamidian massacres of the 1890s, which sent so many of our ancestors to America in the first place, or if it was the Young Turk government, which of course carried out the genocide 6 years later. To this day, there is historical debate about which side it was, because at this time they were averse to each other. However, I think one thing, the only thing that they could both agree on was unfortunately their extreme anti-Armenianism. The most historically important thing about this massacre, in addition to the horrible loss of life, is the fact that this massacre, you know, where they say, you know, those who forget history will be forced to repeat it. This massacre is important to note because the way that the Turks created the fear of Armenians in Cilicia was unprecedented, even in comparison to the genocide later and how they decided to do it. There are multiple sources that say that these events started because two Turkish criminals, basically, who were harassing Armenians, were killed by an Armenian.
Vigilante Armenians that said, these are criminals, we got to take them out?
Right, exactly, except the, you know, all the sources on this massacre have pointed to the fact that the Turks created a series of complete falsehoods that even the Turkish record to this, you know, now can show you that these were complete falsehoods. There were basically provocations to get the local Muslim population to hate the Armenians, essentially what it was.
Isn't that amazing, Danny, that even now, to this day, a week after this whole Syria thing happened, and
right.
I mean, even to this day, we deal with false stories and...
Well, that's why I thought it was important. Exactly. The whole world of fake news is so much at our fingertips today, and this is a great example of really the beginnings of it, used by an organized force, a government and local force. So I think it's important for us, again, those who forget their history are forced to repeat it. There was a provocation at the Great Mosque. They say the door of the mosque was covered in excrement, and so they blamed the Armenians. There was, again, the murder of two Turkish criminals by an Armenian carpenter. He wasn't even really a vigilante. He was just a man who was probably defending his property. And,
right.
and I don't want to assume too much, but we now know, of course, that all of these accusations have been made false.
Right.
There were other ones as well, but basically, after a couple of these things, these falsehoods had been made. Local Turks, they had a meeting, and then a few nights later, they organized not riots, but just like attacks on the Armenian neighborhoods. As these attacks continued, more claims came forward that Armenians had killed a couple men and a couple women, and then they found out that this information was fake. It didn't matter, though, but by that time, there was a huge
damage
crowd.
Damage was done.
A huge crowd gathering, demanding that they start killing Armenians. And in the overall development, basically, is that, you know, it wasn't just Turks, some Kurds from the countryside, and even, believe it or not, I know we're told in history that the Greeks and the Armenians always got along, but a huge amount of immigrants from Crete also took part in the massacre. And they were divided into about 5 or 10 groups. They attacked Armenian quarters, killed men, women, and children, mostly merchants and their families, and then went to the countryside and started killing all the peasantry as well. It's often called the Adana Massacre, which is the biggest city in Cilicia at that time, but it really affected the entire area of Cilicia. And this area is important. It's an important almost step. We've talked about the many separate nations of Armenia. Cilicia is super important to Armenian history because it was the Mediterranean part of what later became the Armenian Kingdom of Cilicia, you know, on the Mediterranean port, during the period that coincided with the Crusades, and it was the last major kingdom of Armenia, albeit separate from historic Armenia. And when Armenians had started moving into this part of Anatolia, they became the dominant group there pretty quickly and then developed their own Armenian kingdom. This is in the Middle Ages. Of course, Armenians lived there much before as well, during the time of Tigran, all the way going back to that. But they had a long historical presence in this area, and this massacre in 1909 was basically the death knell for a large percentage. I mean, granted, it wasn't like what the genocide did, even to this part, because you have to remember the genocide also affected Cilicia afterwards. This was the beginning of Armenian slavery in Cilicia, orphanages and massacres, and you had 25,000 Armenians killed out of a population of 230,000 Armenians. So
let me ask you this, Danny. Let me interrupt real quick. I don't want to forget this. Why is it that when this happens, this butchery, this slaughter happens, and why do Armenians just go on with their everyday life after that and feel that I know you brought up the orphanages and stuff, but even until 1915, it seemed like Armenians just lived like, we accepted that. We're going to move on. Now we can trust the Turkish government. I mean, what makes you still stay in that hellhole, in my mind?
Right. Well, I think I can't answer it with 100% of conviction because, of course, neither one of us was there in that time. We can only speak on rhetorical sort of facets of it. But if I were to answer that, I would say one major part is, of course, it's the homeland theory. I mean, it is their home. It's the Armenians' home. It takes a lot to make mass emigration happened, but mass emigration was happening all the way through that period as well. It's important to note that Armenians had been leaving Cilicia in vast numbers since the 14th century, since the Mamluks conquered the kingdom of Armenian Cilicia, and so the mass emigration was already happening. It's not like they weren't leaving in mass in huge numbers. They were. They were an easy scapegoated community, of course, because as we know. This part of Ottoman history, it was most Christian groups, especially the Armenians, weren't really allowed to carry arms, or even like ride horses, you know what I mean? So it was like they were already at this point dehumanized to the point of being basically second or third class citizens. It's argued that their status to this day is still much like that in Turkey, unfortunately.
It almost sounds like we were the black people in the 1800s, 1700s of America.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. It's definitely very similar to that. It's kind of like a combination of what the black people, the Native Americans, the black people and the Native Americans in a way, because we're the Aborigines of the region. So you have to keep that, you know, maybe not necessarily in Cilicia, but certainly in Greater Armenia, which now constitutes the vast majority of Eastern Turkey and other nations as well. So there was response, however, to this, but again, misinformation, disinformation, fake news, if you will, false rumors, are what allowed the Armenians to try to work with the Turkish government. There were actual responses from sections of the Young Turk government who at least wanted to make it look like they were investigating the problem, the atrocities. And there were a couple of instances during April of 1909, during these massacres and right after, where a Turk and an Armenian were sent by the government, like deputies almost, to go see the situation, see what has been falsified, if it was viable or not. And so the Armenians were working, I don't want to say hand in hand, but there were definitely Armenian members of
right, but
of
you know what?
Turks.
You know what?
This
though
is before
that
the Young Turks went and committed the genocide, so you have to remember that
right.
At this time the Armenians thought that the Young Turks were going to help them too. The Young Turks had just reestablished the up until that point the nulled Ottoman constitution, which allowed for minority rights for the first time, and so of course all the minorities of the Ottoman Empire were trying to work hand in hand with the Young Turks at this time in order to overthrow the Sultan, who they all looked at as a despot, as a tyrant, even Turks. So it was important to note that there was this action against the Sultan by both Turks, Armenians, Greeks, other people, and then there was also what the young Turks themselves were doing. We always talk about the Young Turks because we know they're basically the ones, they're like what the Nazis were for the Holocaust. The Young Turks were the ones responsible for carrying out the genocide. But at the very beginning, when the Young Turk Party started, they had two or three different factions, if you will, that believed in different goals for the Young Turk Party. There was what they call the liberal faction of the Young Turk Party that didn't believe in anti-Armenianism at all and wanted to work with minority groups in order to create a more stable Ottoman Empire. They were pushed out by people like Talat Pasha and Enver, and they were pushed out of their own party. So much like political parties to this day, you have, at the very beginning, I'm not trying to be an apologist for them because they were the ones that carried out the genocide, and they may have had a bigger part in this Adana massacre as well. But there were factions within the Young Turk Party that believed in minority rights. They were just pushed out by the, hardliners. They were pushed out by the hardliners, like Talat, who were complete purveyors of anti-Armenianism.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, this brings a very interesting question on this one. We lost 25,000
in this,
1909. Now, how many people do you think had the mass exodus to get out of Turkey?
At that time?
At that
Cilicia?
Time. And what I mean by that is out of the country of Turkey.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know for certain that a good portion of these people were definitely scared enough. Some of the ones who survived were scared enough to just leave. You know that a large portion was just like, all right, we're leaving. In fact, French warships followed by Italian, British, and several other European nations had arrived on the shores of Alexandretta near Cilicia right after this period. And it's much very similar to what had happened at Musadak. You know, it's the
right.
Here come the French warships. So they knew that many of these refugees, if you will, escaped in this manner, you know, by vessel on the Mediterranean Sea. It just so happens the Cilician Armenians geographically, much like the ones in Constantinople, much more lucky geographically by having instant access to the maritime. Whereas Greater Armenia, as you know, the part of Armenia that was most affected by the genocide,
yeah.
very inland, you know, right. and only traversed by the Black Sea, where many of them were drowned, or the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, where many of them were thrown and drowned, as well as you know. So the one advantage, albeit not a huge advantage, but a little advantage that the Cilician Armenians had was being able to have some access to the sea, which allowed them to leave. Yes, many of them did leave at this point. I don't know the exact figures for how many left, but I can tell you that before the massacre, there were 230,000 Armenians in the Cilician part of Turkey, of the Ottoman Empire. There were at least 25,000 murdered, so that leaves a population of around 200,000 to 205,000 Armenians left in Cilicia, probably equal as great of a number probably left at that point, possibly even more.
Okay.
Bringing the number down significantly more. Now, there were also some Muslims killed in these massacres, and that answers the other part of your question about I don't know if you want to call it acts of revenge, but there were certainly, you know, some Armenians certainly, I mean, out of anger of their whole family being murdered, I'm sure went into other neighborhoods and tried to exact revenge, or possibly these figures of dead Muslims could very well be the attackers themselves being repulsed by Armenian.
Right. Well, where I was going with this was, if this slaughter, mm-hmm. 25,000. Now, mm-hmm. if 1915, if they had this extermination, this genocide, there would have been a lot more Armenians to die if, let's say, these 25,000 souls didn't go without an awakeness that we need to leave and get out of here as well. So this mass exodus actually, helped for the 1915 that these people had already left that place as
had
well.
Had already left.
Yeah.
There's definitely an argument that can be made for that, that their exodus allowed them to live another day. And the same thing can be argued for the Hamidian massacres in 1895, that large portions of the Armenians had left certain areas and weren't there when the genocide had happened. Sure. It's also important to note that about 10,000 Armenians likely starved or went without food or water during this Adana massacre. And it's also very important to note just under 1,500 Assyrians were killed as well in the same massacre. So in most of these anti-Armenian massacres and riots through the ages, you also have a proportional to its population parallel massacre of Assyrians going alongside almost every one of these massacres,
right.
going all the way back to like Genghis Khan and the Mongol invasions. Almost every time that they massacred Armenian populations, there were proportional Assyrian populations that were smaller, smaller group of Assyrians living in the peripheral areas that were also massacred en masse with the Armenians. So in addition to the 25,000 Armenians, about 1,500 Assyrians were also killed in Cilicia, which is a pretty big number considering there wasn't a huge Assyrian population in Cilicia compared to other parts of the Ottoman Empire. So
right.
It's important to note them as well.
I want to run this question by you. I brought it up to Chris when the show started, and I'll bring it up to you here. Do you think the movie The Promise, the time is not good right now with the climate of what is happening with American Syria? Now you got America that's going to need a little bit of an assurance from Turkey that, hey, we need our stuff there, and we're friends with you. We're 100% behind you now and all this because of the whole climate of Syria, Russia, Iran. All this stuff is now to where America kind of needs more friendship than ever in that part of the region. Now, we've got a movie coming out, The Promise, and I'm not sure if this is the right timing. Now, I know it's coming out, and God bless. I hope I'm wrong, but the American world's now going to say, yeah, that's a shame that happened, but
But there's that damn word but. We need Turkey.
Yeah. Well, I think that that you're right in one way, and I think that in that the situation has suddenly become slightly more political or politicized, I should say, because of the events of the past 24 hours. That being said, now could never be, it could never be a better time given the cultural significance. And much like I said with the massacre at Adana, the Cilician massacres, being basically purported by false rumors, and again, another aspect of it that they mentioned was they thought Fedayis were coming down from Zeytun and were going to destroy Adana, so they had to kill all the Armenians so they wouldn't join with the Fedayis from Zeytun. Of course, none of the Fedayis from Zeytun were coming. Most of the Fedayis from Zeytun were killed in 1894, about two decades prior. So it was just complete BS. But to give you, you know, I think... Shora Agdashlu, who was an Iranian actress, she's in The Promise. She's brilliant, one of the Middle East's finest actresses, and she's been in many, many historical movies of this type, and is a lifelong friend of the Armenian people. She mentioned in a press conference that now is more poignant a time than ever, because... although, yes, the political situation with Turkey and the necessity of the United States to rely on the second biggest NATO power is viable. The thing, I think the only thing that's more viable than that is the human condition of Syrian people marching out of their homeland and being massacred left and right and basically harangued, you know, just completely harassed by almost everyone, right. And then stuck in the middle, including the Armenians of Syria, just completely stuck in the middle. I think now, you know, she said something like, now is a more poignant time than ever to see the importance of a film like this. And I think she couldn't be more right. I think that that's absolutely
I agree. I'm just saying more like what has happened, what has transpired in the last 24 hours,
I agree with you.
Yeah.
But even the response of the United States as president right now is one in response to the human condition. So again, I think the poignancy of it is about whether you are on one side or the other, and in any situation regarding this, I think that everybody can agree that they'd like to improve the human condition in Syria, and that the human condition when it comes to, you know, women, children, babies, and just the poor people, the civilians themselves, it does have a direct tie-in to the Armenian genocide, both geographically and culturally, and also just in terms of what's kind of happening, just in general. It could be almost anywhere on Earth and have some kind of tie-in to that in terms of loss of life and sort of purposeful destruction, you know.
Yeah.
So it's the kind of thing that I think is you know, although every case is special and different in their own way, it is definitely a poignant similarity that I think it makes the promises coming out all the more important. I just hope, I do agree with you, though, that there is a political correctness or a... I agree with you. I totally understand what you're trying to say. It is very evident, especially for us Armenians, that, you know, every time...
Time and time again.
Every time we're about to get some kind of, you know, progress in terms of spreading the word about our plight and thus helping future right. generations, it always, you know, something. But again, to quote another cast member from The Promise, Oscar Isaac, who plays the lead role in The Promise, said a very poignant thing, too. I was actually watching one of their cast interviews, and he had said, you know, everybody talks about this is really political, it's real difficult and really political. He's like, well, it's only political for the other side. He's like, for the people who it happened to, it's just the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, you can't fight the truth. He's like, the only reason you make it political is because the truth is hard for you, so it becomes political. So right. if the truth is hard for you as a group, it has to do with some kind of common collective guilt, in other words, you know what I mean? But he put it really well. It's like, it's only political for the other side. For the people it happened to, it's just the truth. That's all
right,
it is.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And
I agree, so Akbar. Very good again. You know
thank
what?
You.
I never knew that April was such a
real shitty month for the Armenian history.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, April. If I'm in Turkey back in then, and April comes around, it's like run, get out of April time.
Yeah, get out.
April.
Yeah.
It's
that's why I think it's all the better that LA County has made April Armenian History Month,
absolutely.
The official Armenian History Month.
Yeah. Bravo. All right, Danny, thank you very much. You got anything going on this weekend?
This is the only weekend I will be off for almost the rest of the year.
Really?
We're going on some serious touring the next several months, so this is kind of my last off weekend.
You know what you guys ought to do? You guys ought to play one Armenian old Fidai song, or not song, but the music. Just play the music, and I wonder if you guys could contrast it together just for this April 24th.
Oh, yeah, that'd be very nice. I like to point out, too, that at the concerts, I oftentimes, during my solos, incorporate Armenian revolutionary songs, political songs, folk songs, work songs, any melody that's common and familiar to the Armenian people, I tend to incorporate that into my solo.
Bravo,
stuff.
Danny. Bravo.
You'll be bound to hear anything.
Bravo, Yekhbar. I wish you nothing but the best, and we'll get together in the future. And when can you come on next week or the week after, or are you going to be busy?
I can definitely come on next week.
Excellent. Okay, we will talk to you, and you take care.
Great. Thanks again, guys.
Thanks, Danny.
Bye-bye.
Well, Chris, that's another history lesson that I never knew.
Absolutely.
About the Armenian history.
Yeah, amazing.
Danny's outstanding.
He is. So much knowledge.
I thought it was all about just music, but no. This guy brings it to the table. I love it. I love the stuff that Danny tells us. Folks, I hope you love the show. I hope you guys are sharing the show. I hope you guys... Why can't you guys go on iTunes? I got so many listeners. Why can't you go on iTunes and just hit a review? Say, you like the show. I mean...
It's
I know you
hard.
Guys. It's not hard at all. Press a couple buttons for me, will you? In any case, I like for you guys to give us a nice review. We're trying to get the best type of ethnic show out there that mixes cultures and stuff. They have every category like that on iTunes, and it helps out big time for me.
It does help a lot.
Whenever you guys go to iTunes and leave a review, when you leave a good review, don't leave a crappy review.
Please
either.
Don't do that.
Yeah, if you're going to do that, don't even get on here. But in any case, Armenians got to show support for one another, and I could sure use yours on this one. Go to iTunes, go to ArmeniaProud.com on there. Is it ArmeniaProud.com or is it just ArmeniaProud?
ArmeniaProud.com, yeah.
iTunes?
No, it's just ArmeniaProud on
iTunes.
It's
just ArmeniaProud on iTunes.
But if you enter the website, it should still show up. So
really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Because the website's in the description. So.
Okay. All right. Perfect on that. So just go there, leave us a good review. And when you're doing that too, now I'm digging into your Amazon account. Why don't you go to ArmeniaProud.com, and on your right-hand side, you see Amazon. If you're going to shop on Amazon, I'm just saying, if you're going to shop on Amazon, why not go through ArmeniaProud.com first, and it's on your right-hand side, Amazon. Click on Amazon and shop away. I mean, I'm not telling you to go to Amazon. I'm telling you that if you're going to shop on Amazon, why not go through our site first and shop on Amazon?
Absolutely.
So that would be great. Well, that's another big show, my friend.
It is. Lots of stuff about Missouri wine and all kinds
Missouri
of exciting
wine
stuff.
With
the Promise.
Danny bringing on.
Danny's stuff.
Yeah, it's been
We're
beautiful.
Loaded up today.
Another great show here and a very informative show. So
absolutely.
I'm very excited about it. And
history, the world events.
Of course. And you know what, folks? Be safe, be healthy, and... again, show your support for The Promise. It's going to be a very good film. And you know what? Any Armenians out there that are downplaying this and not getting involved, you know, shame on you. This is something that we all need to get involved in and keep sharing, keep letting people know about it. Even The Last Inhabitant, that was an outstanding movie. These are Armenian people out there, Armenian writers, Armenian directors that are trying their best
to get something going and support that. The Promise, it's written by Americans. But you know what? It's stuff that happened in our history. Show the world that we care. And it's just not about us having this conflict inside of us saying about the Armenian Genocide. Let the world know about it. And it's always a torch like this that has to be lit. And that's what it's all about, being an Armenian. Keep the heritage, keep the culture alive. Chris, have a great weekend.
You too, Jono.
Brian, thanks for working the boards again. Another thumbs up. I don't think he can talk. And, hey, from me, from Jono, Genatsit Kisher Party. We'll see you guys next week.
Tune in next week for another episode of A Toast to Armenia with Jono Kabinjian. Find the show online at ArmeniaProud.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation at Facebook.com/ArmeniaProud or Twitter at ArmeniaProud. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.